From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events in Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, coming to us from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, bring us up to date.
Well, we haven't spoken for a couple of weeks now, Don, so there's a lot to catch up on.
For sure.
We can look at stuff with a close focus and look at stuff from a focus a bit further away.
Yeah.
One of the things that taking a more regional focus is to over the next couple of days there's a very important CARICOM meeting, the group of Caribbean countries, their economic and political framework, CARICOM. And that's taking context, obviously, in a very difficult wider regional context, with the United States putting a lot of pressure on Venezuela and right-wing governments and right-wing political forces throughout the region making a strong offensive together with their U.S. and European allies to try and consolidate the control and grip that they've been able to build up over the last couple of years in the region.
Right.
So the CARICOM meeting is quite important in that context, because the CARICOM bloc of countries are the countries that have been mainly responsible for blocking United States attempts in the Organization of American States to apply OAS sanctions, Organization of American States sanctions, against Venezuela.
Elsewhere, also in other regional groupings, too, the CARICOM group has been very protective of the ALBA grouping, basically.
Yeah, and more particularly of the Petro-Caribe Agreement, which was started by, it was the brainchild of Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez back in 2004. Mm-hmm. The Petro-Caribe Initiative is an initiative originally designed to help countries at a time of very volatile oil prices have some stability in their energy supplies. And a couple of years ago, and I'm not sure if one or two countries have blocked out, have dropped out, but the bloc had a total of something like 19 countries across Central America and the Caribbean of all political shades. It won because it wasn't designed to try and strengthen political allies. It was designed as a development cooperation initiative to benefit the whole Central American and Caribbean region.
Right. This was one of those things that we've discussed where, regardless of the political inclinations of these right-wing governments, for example, the benefits to the member countries, to the participants, were so strong and so material that they'd be hard-pressed to explain to their own constituents why they're not participating. When you have something like, for example, well, you have to buy oil from somebody. If you buy it here, when you go to pay it back, you can spend half of the money on yourself instead of sending it to the oil company. It's hard to turn that kind of stuff down.
Yeah, they were very favorable terms. It was the people had to pay 50% of the price of the oil they received, I think within 90 days.
Right.
And the other 50% they could repay over 25 years at 2% interest.
Right.
Where in the world are you going to get favorable terms like that? But one of the there was a kind of conditionality, namely that in order to benefit from that deal, that concessionary deal, the governments concerned had to commit to using the 50% that they had to pay back over a long time for social investments and investment in agricultural credit and stuff like that.
Local development. In other words, if you invest this in yourself instead of sending it to us to help pay off interest or whatever, then that's okay. We'll credit that against the repayment and or enable you to do it on these long-term agreements instead of on a short-term agreement.
Yeah, and that's all. And So that originally was almost exclusively to do with oil supplies. Yep. But as Petrocaribe developed, they realized that they had to pay more attention to things like food security and food sovereignty. Yep. And so Petrocaribe, if you read the reports, the internal reports about what Petrocaribe is doing, you'll find working groups on stuff like food security, for example, or climate change and stuff like that. And so that what Petrocaribe takes an integral view of energy needs and how it's related to the rest of the participating countries' economies. So and a very important and in regional initiative that's come under a lot of pressure recently from visits by people like Rex Tillerson and currently another Secretary of State for Latin America is doing another visit, not to the Caribbean, but to other countries, and that just indicates in the region. I think it's Chile, Peru, and Argentina that he's visiting, and that so this flurry of visits from high-level U.S. State Department officials, including the Secretary of State himself, Rex Tillerson. Indicates the level of interest, the new level of interest over the last 12 months that the United States is dedicating now to try and support its right-wing allies in the region and attack its what it regards as its enemies.
Right.
And so and part of that is to put pressure on the CARICOM countries to drop Petrocaribe.
Right.
And to work with the United States to meet their energy needs.
Right.
Now, they're not going to do that voluntarily because the United States is not offering them anything like the concessionary terms that members of Petrocaribe get from Venezuela.
Right.
Now, far from it. So and what's going on behind the bogus benevolent rhetoric that you're getting out of Tillerson and his colleagues in the U.S. State Department is that they'll be putting on a kind of a friendly face without offering anything substantial, and behind the scenes they'll be saying, "Do what we want, or else."
Right. It's barely behind the scenes, by the way. I mean, they get you had Tillerson in Austin, you know, saying basically, "Hey, yeah, this Monroe Doctrine is a pretty cool thing. You know, we like it. Yeah."
Right.
So that's so not there, subtle.
Yeah, so there's this kind of regional diplomatic Game of Thrones going on, if
right.
you like.
Yeah, right.
With the United States trying to marshal its allies and put pressure on potential allies to try and get a majority in the OAS, in the Organization of American States, that will enable it to get some kind of sanctions approved by that body against Venezuela. Now, they had another try at that just a few days ago, last week, in which they called a meeting to discuss the internal situation in Venezuela in complete contravention of the OAS's own rules.
Right.
And Nicaragua, and some people had been saying, oh, well, Nicaragua's taking a low profile. Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo they're going to be very careful about how they express themselves on the issue of Venezuela. Well, that was nonsense.
Right.
Because in that meeting, in that essentially illegal meeting called by Luis Almagro and his secretariat, Nicaragua very clearly stated that they rejected the meeting. They regarded it as a completely illegitimate meeting, and they again expressed their 100% solid support for the Venezuelan government, and that was particularly significant because it was on the anniversary of the murder of Augusto C. Sandino, the Nicaragua's national hero, by the Nicaraguan dictator on the orders of the United States ambassador at the time, Arthur Bliss Lone.
Right.
And so the whole thing around Venezuela is beginning to crystallize, and it's very difficult to see how that situation is going to work out over the next 6, 9, 12 months, especially given the fact that the Venezuelan government and the Venezuelan authorities, based on a decision by the country's National Constituent Assembly, which is currently in session, again to hold elections on, what is the day, April the 22nd?
I believe that's true, yeah.
Yeah, and so there was a move by the Venezuelan authorities to try and get the legislative elections. Also, I think Nicolas Maduro suggested to the electoral authority that they hold the legislative elections at the same time as the presidential elections. And the presidential elections were originally scheduled for December this year, but the National Constituent Assembly brought them forward. And Maduro suggested to the National Electoral Authority that they could do the same with the legislative elections, but the electoral authority turned around and said that they didn't think that was a good idea. And so the only election scheduled for April are the presidential elections. Now, those presidential elections, the main opposition parties, Primera Justicia and Popular Will, they've stated that they're not going to take part in those elections, but almost all the other opposition parties are. Now, there are a total of 18 political parties in Venezuela that have contested recent elections, as I understand it. And of those 18, 15 of those political parties are going to take part. So although the main opposition parties, Primera Justicia and Voluntad Popular, have said that they're not going to take part, that doesn't delegitimize the elections, because a very broad range of political opinion is represented by the 15 parties that will be contesting those elections.
Right.
And of course, that situation comes on foot of the recent decision by the Venezuelan opposition to reject an agreement. And I think we discussed this in our last program a couple of weeks ago. The Venezuelan opposition rejected an agreement that they'd given the impression they were on the point of signing.
Right.
They rejected that agreement for a kind of peaceful coexistence with the government of Nicolas Maduro. And what we've seen subsequent to that outside Venezuela, very hostile moves by Colombia, for example, moving troops to the frontier,
yep.
Supposedly for internal security reasons.
Yep.
Brazil is the internal situation. Brazil is becoming more and more volatile as they get closer to the presidential elections,
right,
with the threat, the judicial threat that hangs over the most popular candidate,
right, yeah, right,
by a mile.
Right.
Lula da Silva, he leads the polls by a mile. I mean,
right,
he'd obviously win the elections if he were allowed to stand, but
right. Right.
I suspect that he will. The judicial system will work against him,
right,
and he will not be able to participate as a candidate. Now,
yeah, that's like they're fixing two in a row, basically. They removed Dilma Rousseff, clearly illegitimately, although it was formally proper. And now the same thing with Lula.
In the Lula case, and the evidence against him has always been completely inadequate in terms of, there was more than reasonable doubt that the charges against him were completely false. But that's become even clearer now that a database has been discovered that was being tampered with by the very people that were accusing Lula. So and it was evidence from that database that led the prosecutor Silvio Mora to build his case against Lula in the first place. So
look at the previous situation. What Dilma was accused of, isn't even an offense.
No.
So no. And yet she was removed from office over it.
Yeah. So we've said this so many times. It doesn't matter what the evidence is. The process, as long as they can give some kind of semblance of legitimacy to the process, the legal process, and the administrative process, that's what matters, and that's all that matters to them. The truth of the matter,
right?
Even hard evidence.
But
even if there's no evidence, it doesn't matter. But that goes together, Don, with what's happening now, whereby the Michel Temer, the usurper president in Brazil, is militarizing policing in various urban centers. But that looks like looked at from outside Brazil, I don't know what it looks like from inside Brazil, but what it looks like from looking to someone monitoring the region is that the Brazilian authorities are preparing for a military uprising. Crackdown around the elections.
Right. Yeah, they're preparing for an uprising. I mean, in essence, here's the situation there. You had both Lula's term and then Rousseff's term. Even with the manipulations and just the market problems with commodities, the things that impacted revenues, that caused some problems in the economy there, and the wrecking that accompanies, the ascendance to power of a socialist or even a progressive government. They just start messing with it from the outside. People's situation improved, and their expectation that it would continue to improve became almost institutionalized in a good, substantial sector of the population. And then you had this thing that was done with Rousseff, which clearly looked stinky to anyone looking at it, even if they accepted the legitimacy of it because it was under the forms, under their law, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is terrible, but, at least it's not a general taking over and, et cetera. Now they're doing it again. Accompanying this charade in politics, of course, is the reality setting in that, in fact, your situation is no longer improving and it's going to get worse. And so there's a point in time. I mean, this is what we saw with Sanders and Trump in the United States. You can have the best line of bull possible disseminated over the loudest loudspeaker and plugged into every single brain in the whole population and sell the best fantasy. After a while, you can't tell people they're not hungry if they haven't eaten in 2 weeks or a month. Their body takes over and tells them what to do. And they're going to reach that point in Brazil.
Yeah. Reality goes on existing, as it were, your back.
That's right.
So, and you, it suddenly surprises you. But the other thing to bear in mind about the militarization that Temer is implementing in Brazil is that does have a regional significance in terms of the pressure on Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of last year, there were military exercises involving various countries, including the United States, in Brazil, only 100 kilometers or so from the Venezuelan border. Venezuela has quite a long border with Brazil. It has a 1,200-kilometer border with Colombia. So anything involving militarization in those countries is implicitly a threat to Venezuela.
Right.
And then if you look at the situation in Colombia, that what you were just talking about how the situation in Brazil is an attempt to control dissent.
Right.
There in Colombia, you have a situation where they have elections, I think towards the end of next month. I've forgotten the exact date of the presidential elections in Colombia. But there are a couple of things going on. The government withdrew from peace talks with the only important remaining guerrilla group in Colombia, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional. Right. It looks as though that they might be back on track, but that's not clear. But what is clear is that the FARC guerrillas who signed the peace agreement in good faith and are now trying to participate as a legitimate political party in Colombia's electoral campaign for the Colombian presidency, they're getting murdered.
Right.
And in general, community leaders and indigenous peoples are being attacked, and the government is doing nothing about it.
Let's be clear here. When you say they're being murdered, we're not talking, this isn't a political term. This isn't symbolically murdered, slaughtered at the polls. This is, they're being murdered, dragged out of the house, shot, disappeared.
And so the at one point, the FARC stopped campaigning. I don't think they've taken the decision to begin campaigning again because it was just too dangerous for their candidates.
Yes, May 27th is the first round of presidential, and then the 17th of June, the second round, if it's necessary.
Right. So then, and just look at the figures. In January, I think it was around 30 indigenous and community leaders were murdered in Colombia who were not on party political grounds. It was just because they were active in their communities, defending the interests of their communities.
Right.
And then on top of that, you had the murder, and I'm not sure of the exact number, and it could be as high as 20 members, ex-members of the FARC, who've also been murdered.
Right.
You know, so that, so if, but none of that gets reported in any serious way in the Western mainstream corporate media.
Right. I mean, that's germane too. Look, what's happening in terms of the way they're fraying the peace agreement is that it favors the continued ability of the paramilitary groups to operate. And so, for example, when you talk about activity at the Venezuelan border, you know, if the government has firm control of everything, then an action taken against Venezuela would be an act of the Colombian state and you know, everything that goes with that. However, if you have a president who's honestly trying to hold together this peace agreement, whether that's what he's doing or not, by the way, because no one can say for sure he has total control of the situation there either. Right. But, you know, well, gee, we tried, but, you know, these groups that are loyal to, you know, the former president, they're out of our control, and it was one of them probably that you know, snuck in and killed 11 Venezuelan security people or whatever. You know, so you got this game going on where there's instability on both sides that will allow not just military action within those countries, but also against Venezuela, since they both border it.
Yeah, and the United States is very, very clearly putting pressure on Juan Manuel Santos, right, to take a hard line against Venezuela. So then, and if you look at all that stuff in the regional context, and there's that going on, it's very clear that the United States and its right-wing allies are trying to consolidate their position. Today, that subsecretary of state from the U.S. State Department is visiting. He has a meeting with Lenin Moreno in Ecuador.
Yeah.
And so there again, we're almost certain to see some kind of announcement over the next few days in which Ecuador's foreign policy position is likely to shift, probably only very slightly.
Right.
But over time, I have no doubt at all that, yeah, Ecuador will probably leave ALBA.
Yeah, we know where it's going. I mean, they'll start with, we completely support Venezuela so long as she continues on her current path to seek reconciliation. And that's going to morph into, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's too bad that the revolution was betrayed by Maduro, and now let's get him. That's where they're going with this guy.
That might well be the way the official propaganda line goes.
Right.
But in fact, for Lenin Moreno, he's in a very difficult situation, yeah, because he made a deal with the devil, the devil being the Ecuadorian right wing.
Right.
And that means that he's lost a lot of support. And although his referendum that he held a few weeks ago, which was essentially a referendum based on initiatives in favor of Ecuador's ruling business classes.
Right.
But that Rafael Correa's bloc, despite all the disadvantages that they suffered, still got 36% of the vote,
right,
which makes them, it may be a mistake to think of that 36% as solid support for Correa,
right,
but it's certainly a bloc of opinion, the biggest bloc of opinion in Ecuador.
I think it also, you know, the deal with the devil that Moreno made, from his point of view, I don't think is the deal he made with the right. It's becoming clear that he actually is of the right. And so the deal with the devil he made was playing the game that he did in order to get the vote that belonged to, you know, to Correa. So, in other words, he told the Ecuadorian people, this is what I'm going to do for you, and now he's going to not do it. And these people are used to getting that stuff delivered when it's promised.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, that's his deal with the devil problem is going to be there, when he's like, oh, I shouldn't have got into power this way, because these people are going to hold me accountable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, and we've only got a few minutes left on, and
there's so much
else to look. And looking at that in a regional context, what you were talking about earlier about reality, people waking up to reality and realizing that the electoral promises that were made to them were complete nonsense, as if, you know, as if there's anything new in that.
Yeah, right.
But you can see that very clearly in Argentina. I mean, you can see it very clearly in Honduras, of course, where the opposition continues to protest.
Well, in Honduras, and you know, the people in Honduras know that the government's illegitimate because they had to actually remove them from office in the one hand, and the other hand, you know, block the guy's access to the front door of the presidential palace by theft. So nobody's fooling them. No, the people in Honduras know. Nobody's fooling them.
Yeah, I think that to some extent they are deluding themselves when they kind of appeal to the international community.
Well, yeah, but what can you do though? I mean,
Or they think that they're going to get some result out of the Organization of American States, you know, which has played a very cynical, hypocritical double game in Honduras.
Well, I'm glad you went there because I wanted real quick. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you today, but this one thing I want to get across when we're talking about the OAS. And talking about interfering, Article 19 says no state or group of states has the right to intervene directly or indirectly for any reason whatsoever in the internal or external affairs of any other state, period. Right. And it says not only armed force, any other form of interference or attempted threat against the state, the personality, its political, economic, and cultural elements. In other words, stay the hell out of each other's business.
Right. And of course, the United States has never...
Right. They've been using it as an instrument to do exactly that. I mean, that's the enabling purpose of this group for the United States. It is itself an intervention in the affairs of all of the other states in the West.
Sure. So there's all that going on, but one shouldn't take the view that the United States and its right-wing regional allies have it all their own way. So, for example, in Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he's well ahead in the opinion polls, not to the same extent as Lula in Brazil, but sufficiently well ahead to make it look as though he stands a good chance, finally, of defeating the Mexico's corrupt electoral system. We won't know until July.
Right.
But he will be a very difficult... if he makes it to the presidency, he'll be a very difficult person for the United States to co-opt. And then you have political leaders like López Obrador, like Lula, like Manuel Zelaya and Salvador Nasralla in Honduras, who are very prominent and well able to project an opposition point of view that contradicts the U.S. propaganda line.
Right.
Then in Argentina and Brazil and elsewhere, you have very widespread public protests against the failed neoliberal policies,
right,
as far as they're concerned, as far as the poor majority is concerned, they're failed policies. Of course, as you constantly point out, they're not failed policies from the point of view of the elite.
Right.
But you also have what we've talked about in the past, on many occasions, the contradictions at a very high level in economic and trade terms between the regional governments and the need for them to develop their trade and economic relations with China in particular, but with Asia in general, and how that contradicts the wishes of the United States. So that also generates very difficult contradictions. And for example, even though Sebastian Piñera is going to assume the presidency in Chile very soon, his predecessor Michelle Bachelet has just finished a tour of Asia. And in Japan, she had some very important meetings in Japan.
Yep.
So
yeah, there's a lot of foot.
It's not just China.
That's right. There's a whole, well, look at Nicaragua, for example, has excellent trade relations with Taiwan, which is, you know, seems like a complete contradiction, but it's a fact. Right, we got to stop here because we're out of time. And when we pick it up next week, I'd like to maybe start here, and because also it'd be a very interesting dynamic to have this outsider come to the presidency in Mexico, given the dynamics with the United States with Trump.
Yeah,
it'd be an opportunity for Trump. So. Okay, we got to stop there, and I will be back with you as soon as we can manage that, and I appreciate your time as always.
Okay, look forward to it, Don.
Yep,
take care.
I'll see you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.